thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I think, as was the point done by our conveners, I'm going to go completely on kind of the other end of the spectrum for input removal experiments and talk about two very different experiments that I've worked on over the years, one in an undisturbed forest ecosystem and the other in an agroecosystem. So now we have three different, completely different ecosystems. And the thing that links these experiments is the fact that the input removal components of the experiment was critical to understanding some of the underlying mechanisms and principles governing soil organic matter stabilization and destabilization. Without the input removal component, I don't think that we would have been able to tease apart some of those specific drivers of carbon stabilization and carbon sequestration, and as has already been mentioned, the role that can play, I think, in carbon mitigation, particularly in management decisions moving forward. Okay, to acknowledge first off my co-authors, some of these projects have been ongoing for about 15 years, so I tried at the bottom to list everybody that's been involved, but the et cetera at the end, I really mean it. There's lots of people that have been involved over the years, and funding has come from multiple agencies. Okay, so one of the things I wrote in the abstract is sometimes you don't know what you've got until you've lost it. So that really gets to the heart of these input manipulation and particularly removal experiments. And manipulative experiments in general can really reveal aspects of the ecology of soil carbon dynamics. I'm an ecologist by training, and so I'm always looking for the interconnectedness among different mechanisms, inputs, and how they are stabilized in soil. And so through the process of elimination, often these manipulative experiments can be very, very powerful. In particular, input elimination or removal experiments peel away at these intertwined processes that protect soil organic matter from further decomposition or promotes soil carbon stabilization or carbon sequestration. And from this 2011 concept paper, paradigm paper, inputs enter into the below ground, into the mineral soil profile, and through microbial processing enter into multiple intertwined mechanisms that work together to then dictate turnover times or mean residence time of carbon. These include a physical disconnection where the organic matter is disconnected from microbial enzymatic activity, microbial decomposition. Often we think about aggregates and the role of aggregate protection within this context. The second is sorption desorption, or really organo-mineral interactions, the sorption on mineral surfaces. And then when applicable, the physical pressures of freeze-thaw cycles is really important as well. And so today I'm going to talk about two very different systems, one undisturbed forest ecosystem and one managed agroecosystem. And really, again, what binds these two is how we were able to really tease apart some of these important mechanisms by use of different forms of input removal treatments. So the first undisturbed forest ecosystem is part of a dirt plot. So this old-growth coniferous forest is undisturbed, not managed, located in Oregon in the Pacific Northwest. These are andesols, so high concentration of volcanic ash-derived non- or poorly crystalline minerals is part of the soil characterization. And many people are familiar with the dirt, the detritus input and removal treatments. It's part of a network, an international network of sites, some of which have recently passed their 20-year mark, and some of which are about to pass their 20-year mark, including the H.J. Andrews. So we're coming into thinking about some follow-up questions that we can really get at some of these longer-term aspects at this site, which is why I really got interested in presenting some of these data today. So all of the dirt treatments have these common manipulative experiments such that there's a control forest plot and a double litter plot, where the litter is removed from a no-litter plot and then transferred onto the double litter plot. And then there's a series of litter removals, above-ground litter removal, and then both below-ground and above-ground, and then no roots. So there's a whole series of sort of subtractive manipulative experiments. And at the Andrews, after 16 years, we've seen declines in total soil carbon measured just in the top 10 centimeters with the input removal treatments. Now, this trend has been shown and published in many papers across the network, And so particularly in 2014, there was several papers that looked pretty carefully at that. And so kind of to be a little bit different today, I'm going to talk more about this experimental treatment, the double litter. Now, this is supposed to be a litter removal talk, so wait for it. but this decrease in soil carbon, we attributed in a 2009 paper to soil priming, or a priming effect. As a result of the added substrate with the double litter, we found multiple signs that there was a strong priming effect. And so from this classic model from Kuziakoff, soil without substrate has a certain amount of carbon dioxide respired, and then soil with a substrate added has an additional amount of carbon dioxide respired as a result of the added substrate. But with positive priming, there is also a component of residual soil organic matter that is lost in addition. That's the soil priming. And you can measure it by measuring carbon dioxide efflux and use the subtractive method of the dirt treatments in order to estimate that. And so when we did that by season, we found that overall there's a net positive priming effect. And so we attributed that soil carbon loss to this positive priming effect. But over time, I started to think about this question down here. Can this really account for the total amount of lost soil carbon, particularly as we go into the longer and longer term aspects of this site? So as part of the initial kind of justification or interpretation of priming, some of the data that we showed in this 2009 paper was a long-term decline in DOM flux, so DOC that moves, percolates through the forest floor, was substantially reduced between the control and the double litter over time, a reduction in dissolved organic matter flux as a result of the double litter. And we interpreted that as microbes were utilizing this as a substrate and contributing to the priming effect. But we know in this site that sorption of dissolved organic matter is known to be an important driver of carbon stabilization. And so another way of thinking about this, well, you can see from the 30 centimeter down to the 1 meter, there's always a decrease. This has always been indication that with the non-crystalline minerals, sorption on mineral surfaces is a really, really important driver of carbon stabilization. And so another way of thinking about this, I've started to think about a new hypothesis explaining all of that soil carbon loss with litter addition. And that mainly, it's the litter additions lead to carbon loss through both priming. Priming does occur, but that's not enough to explain all the soil carbon loss. And so in fact, it's an input removal from the soil. So paradoxically, adding litter and inducing a priming effect in this soil where sorption on mineral surfaces is critical for carbon sequestration, the priming effect is actually also leading to an input removal effect. So the amount of soil priming measured as CO2 flux is a combination of both prime soil carbon and recycling of microbial biomass. And in general, it's too little to account for the total soil carbon loss that we actually measure. Now, we need to do deeper soil sampling, and that's planned for year 20 to confirm. The idea is that priming may occur up in the upper horizons, but in the deeper soil profile, where long-term carbon sequestration is critical, it may actually be carbon losses driven by loss of inputs. And so input removal, in the end, from DOM sorption that no longer occurs as a result of priming is something that may be a critical mechanism driving soil carbon stock changes in the andisol and explain why we've not seen as strong a priming effect in the other dirt sites, or at least not as quickly. Okay, so there's one story, and now let's switch over to the agro ecosystem. So completely different. This study site is now in Hawaii, and this is at an ag research station on amolysol. So high fertility, natural fertility, really, really important agricultural soils, but we want to preserve these soils and manage them in a conservation management regime. And agriculture is increasing in Hawaii, and one of the reasons it's increasing is in the context of biofuel and bioenergy. And so the background on this experiment is that we're looking for conservation management practices to be used during the cultivation of biofuel feedstocks. And the idea is that we may be able to help sequester soil and then offset CO2 emissions that are incurred during the production of the feedstock. So the feedstock itself is considered renewable, but in the production and then transportation and conversion, there are non-renewable emissions that are induced. And so if soil carbon can be managed and so that we increase our soil carbon sequestration in the process, that can be a really, really important offset, both from an economic and an environmental aspect. And so we focused it on perennial grasses, as many people have, even in the tropics. These are non-food crops with the potential to mitigate negative consequences and hopefully have high yield and lower fertilizer, pesticides, and water requirements compared to other crop types. So the grasses such as Napier grass and Guinea grass that we've worked with may store an enormous amount of carbon in the soil as compared to other potential crops because they have an extensive below-ground root system. And not only is it extensive, but you can also, these are perennial crops, so you can harvest them and they grow back just like the grass in your yard. And so the below-ground rhizosphere and the soil profile is left completely intact. So specifically, our objective was to determine the primary drivers of soil carbon change following cultivation of a fallow field. So a lot of land in Hawaii is under pasture or grazing or has gone fallow and is in grasses, and a lot of that land is being eyed to get back into agricultural production. And so the question here was, following cultivation of a fallow field into perennial grasses under zero tillage management. And the hypothesis was that the roots with high lignin will decay less, and those residues will be incorporated into stable, aggregate-protected carbon pools, so this physical disconnection. And that would drive carbon accumulation over time. This was our original hypothesis. And the approach we took was to measure multiple different ecosystem carbon pools and fluxes, and then we got into soil fractionation, specifically the occluded light fraction, which really gets at the aggregate protected, and the chemistry of roots in the fractions and planted and unplanted soils. And that's where the litter removal comes into play. Okay, so for example, started here measuring carbon pools and fluxes. We also measured indicators of quality to link to decomposition. The example I give here, we measure lots of carbon pools and fluxes, but the example I give here is delta soil carbon. So we had a measurable, significant increase in soil carbon on a very short time frame. Remember, this is the tropics. Things happen quickly. And then we also had, for example, a significant difference between our different accessions of multiple species in percent lignin. And then we used the approach of structural equation modeling to actually determine how each of these pools and fluxes drove changes in soil carbon stock after 1 year. And what we found is that yield had a very strong positive influence on root biomass, good, but also that lignin had a negative impact on decomposition, which makes sense, but that low lignin resulted in high decay, and then high decay resulted in high carbon sequestration. Now, that is opposite of what we had expected to happen. And so that isn't what we had hypothesized. And so the accessions with high carbon accumulation had the greatest with high root biomass containing low root lignin, resulting in a high decay rate, but that was not being lost as CO2 back to the atmosphere. It was being accumulated in soil carbon, which we didn't quite buy. So the next series of experiments was to kind of confirm or refute that original finding, and we started looking at soil fractions and pool sizes for the planted, and this is 2010, 2011, 2012, generally increased, and we had some shifts in some of our different pool sizes, but some kind of went up. It was a little bit inconclusive, and this is where the no inputs plot really came into play, because in a short-term experiment, what we did was we measured the same carbon pools and the change over time in the control bear, where nothing was planted at all, and so everything was just decomposing. And the power comes from being able to compare these two to each other and really constrain the influence that those freshly planted cultivars had on soil carbon dynamics over quite short periods of time. Okay, so the next data set that we collected was copper oxide chemistry, so lignin and suberin chemistry of roots and the occluded light fraction. Remember, the hypothesis was that carbon accumulation was being driven by an accumulation within the aggregate protected fraction. And so in PCA space, samples that are close together are more similar. And so start over here with the root inputs, and these are fresh root inputs. Now, roots that were decayed as part of the decay study shifted generally down along the second axis. And then compare that over here to all of our occluded light fraction, which had a very strong shift over with decomposition into the occluded light fraction. Now, the interesting thing here is that the occluded light fraction within the 1 year and 2 year samples actually shifted back up on the second axis, which we take to interpret that it's more similar to those fresh root materials. So this is a sign that confirms our original observations that these fresh root materials are actually what's driving carbon accumulation, and we can see it within the occluded light fraction. But again, the power comes from looking at the control bare occluded light fraction over time, which is very firmly rooted here in the bottom corner as far away from all of the fresh inputs as possible. So a very, very strong indicator that what we are actually seeing is fresh root inputs accumulated in the occluded light fraction. Now, the occluded light fraction is supposed to be a slow, you know, 100 to 300 year turnover carbon pool. But if carbon got in that quickly, then does it come out just as quickly? So I'm really interested in carbon sequestration, not something that's in the short term. So is it stable? To ask that, we developed a three-pool transfer model and then ran the simulation for 6 years. We had 3 years of measurements, so we were only comfortable going out 6 years. But this is an interesting approach because it takes inputs and outputs from the system and also includes pool sizes but transfers between pools. And when you run the simulation out 6 years, you can see our original data points. Again, the control bare, you see everything decreasing over time, and planted, everything increases. But the power comes from comparing that control bare to the planted sites. And then you can see at the beginning stages that the biggest difference between these pool sizes, the biggest difference down here really was in that occluded light fraction. So the chemistry we saw was a very rapid reaction to planted, but the simulations show that over time, the two planted and bare converge for the occluded light fraction and free light fraction. The difference driving long-term carbon sequestration is actually in the dense fraction or the mineral-associated fraction. Okay, so the physical it seems that those physical disconnections are dynamic. Okay, the role of aggregate protection is important, is critical, but it's transitory. So the occluded light fraction responded more slowly, yet accumulated fresh root inputs more rapidly than the free light fraction, probably because the fresh planting actually facilitated the formation of those aggregates. But over time, that organic matter passes through the transitory aggregates into the dense fraction, into the mineral stabilized fraction. Okay, and so he's standing. So in conclusion, again, the commonality between these two very different experiments is how powerful the input removal can be. And sometimes the experiment manifests unexpectedly, like with the priming experiment. But in combination with input addition experiments, they can really reveal dynamics that would have been obscured otherwise. Okay, I'll end there. Thank you. Over drinks later.